You're listening to The Brian D. O'Leary Show, your sanctuary for serious content in an unserious culture.
All right, welcome back. We got Tom Wolfe, Thomas Wolfe here. New book, Baseball in the Roaring Twenties, the Yankees, Cardinals, and the Captivating 1926 Season. Tom, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. Great to be able to talk about some old-time baseball.
Absolutely. Almost 100 years ago now.
Yeah, 99 years ago was the 1926 season, yeah.
Yeah, and you weave in a bunch of history before that that sets up the why this season was, I don't know if it, would you call it the most compelling season or just the most interesting season? You picked this season, 1926, for a reason.
Yeah, the reason, really a couple of reasons. One of them is that it came out of my research for a book I wrote about the 1932 season, which is the book The Called Shot, which was about the Cubs and Yankees and the 1932 World Series and Babe Ruth's Called Shot. And in doing that, the research for that book, I did a lot of research into Ruth, of course, and I was interested in Hornsby, Rogers Hornsby, who was the manager of the Cubs in 1932, up until August when he got fired in the middle of a pennant race. So in 32, Ruth and Hornsby didn't meet. And so I was looking back into, you know, when Hornsby and Ruth played in different, they played in the same era, but they played in different leagues. But the one season where they did collide, their careers collided, was 1926. So that kind of got me hooked on 26. And then when I looked at the Yankees and the Cardinals and what their career, what their franchises had been like in 1926, the Yankees in 25 had finished seventh, 28 games out of first place. Ruth had a terrible season. He was basically written off after the 1925 season. So the Yankees from 25 to 26 went from almost last to first, and Ruth had this rebound year.
Right.
So that gave
in a big
a lot
way.
Of dramatic in a big way, in a big way.
And then for another several seasons, he had a whole nother, you know, phenomenal second half of the career until he went to Boston for the break.
Right. 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 No, you're exactly right. And, you know, Ruth's first 6 years with the Yankees up through 1925, you know, he was kind of the marvel of the American League. He introduced home runs as the dominant way to score in a baseball game. And he became a celebrity and a, you know, this outstanding player who slumped in 25 at age 31, and people wrote him off because he was 31 and overweight, clashing with his manager. But if you look at the career statistics from 31 to 38, the next seven seasons, Ruth averaged more home runs and more RBIs than he did when he was in his 20s. So he had a complete reversal from 25 to 26 and ongoing up until, as you know, the Boston Braves when he finished his career there in 1935.
Right. Yeah. So we could go any number of ways. This book is so rich with facts. And so I guess to give the listeners an idea, not only is it the Yankees, the Cardinals, and the entire 26 season, but you incorporate what else is going on in the sporting world, including the rise of college football, you know, boxing and horse racing, you know, the golden age of sport in the 1920s, but also an interesting thing you weave in every few chapters is the nascent Negro Leagues or black baseball in there, and how that I think 1926 might have been the most impactful season. I'm not sure, but you do go back, I guess, in the early teens, and it looked like, from what I got out of reading you, that there was a good chance pre-World War II that we were on the track to integration then, and then it got stonewalled by, you know, world events and other things, and then the Black Sox scandal, which brings in Judge Kennesaw Mountain Landis, who was really a firm opponent of integration into baseball. Meanwhile, you have John McGraw in the National League, Connie Mack in the American League, and they had made waves of signing black ball players to their teams, and that they got shut down essentially by the powers that be. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, that's a really interesting sort of facet of baseball in the 1920s, that there was this, it was like a parallel universe, the white major leagues and then the Negro leagues. And the Negro leagues really were formed in 1920. The visionary, the person behind it really is a very important person in baseball history. His name is Rube Foster. And he started as a pitcher, and then he became a manager, and then he became an owner. And then he basically became an executive who tried to pull together all the barnstorming teams that played black baseball into a league with a set schedule and a postseason. And he set that up basically in 1920. And the first colored World Series, I believe, was in 1924. So he was the sort of the owner manager of the Chicago American Giants. And then he had a health crisis in 1926 and was hospitalized in a mental institution in Kankakee, Illinois. And he kind of faded out of the game at that point. But it becomes a pivotal year because that's the year that, first of all, it was a really terrific postseason series, which we can talk about later, between the Chicago American Giants and the Atlantic City Giants. An 11-game postseason.
That struck me. I'd not heard that before. I'd heard of the 9-game seasons. I think 1924, perhaps in the major leagues, was the last 9-game series. I kind of like that, but I've talked with some friends about bringing that back. But the 11-game season series seemed like a bridge too far to me. But you got to realize, I think, that they were playing for money, and the more gate receipts they could get. And then you're in October and they played these games of this World Series in a number of different cities, and the weather was a problem. People didn't show up. They showed up in mass, in Chicago, but not in a couple of the other cities, which I thought was, I don't know why. I'm guessing it was, daytime and weather related, but weekday and weather related, perhaps.
Yeah. And of course, the 11 games they played, they didn't plan to play 11. They planned to play best of nine, but two games ended in ties because of darkness. And so in order to get five, for either team to get five wins, they had to go 11 games. And in four, as you know, which is really unique, in four different cities, they moved around. The teams moved around and played the postseason Colored World Series in four different places, which allowed different fan bases to enjoy the games live.
Right. Yeah. And so reading this and knowing a little bit about Rube Foster, but not a ton, I gathered that, but by him, you mentioned a health crisis. He got stuck in a room and maybe breathed some fumes or something on accident, and then was, mentally incapacitated. Then health just went downhill quickly, and I think he died 4 years later or something like that. But it sounded like he was the cult of personality that may have been able, and he was a pretty young guy in his early 50s, I think, at this point, correct? It was a cult of personality almost that sounded like on the track to bring this organization together. I think early on he had designs on not only having the best black ball players play in the big leagues, but, and I'm not sure here, maybe you can shed some light on it, was his intent to then have a separate black league, just like they had the minor leagues of black or white minor leagues, I guess. Was that his intent, or was that just part of the culture perhaps at the time that, you could maybe put some guys in the big leagues, but let's leave everything else the way it is? Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, my take on that is that his ultimate goal was integration of the two leagues, that the best black players and the best white players would play together in one league. Basically what happened began it began to happen in 1948 with Jackie Robinson. Yeah. I mean that was his overall vision, I think. And I thought as he thought as a way to get there needed to be more black teams playing white teams. And one of his ideas, which he threw out to John McGraw, who was favorable to towards it, and also to the Chicago Cubs and White Sox, was that when visiting teams came to Chicago to play the Cubs or the White Sox, they could have an exhibition game against his Chicago American Giants, which would be an all-black team against an all-white team. And I think that got shot down by Major League Baseball because owners were really concerned that if the white major league teams got beaten by the black major league teams, this would spur integration at a time when the country wasn't ready for it, and where white owners were concerned about how it would affect their bottom line also. So
Yeah, and I noticed it was right about 1920 when this really came to a head. And at that time or prior, you'd have black clubs playing, say, in the California Winter League that you mentioned, which had, they'd bring their whole team, and it would just be wouldn't be an integrated team, but it'd be an integrated. It was an integrated league. Same thing in the Cuban Winter Leagues. You'd have the But those that was an integrated league, as far as I understand. Like, there's black and white ball players playing on the same teams, and then of course you have the barnstorming teams later on in the 30s and stuff. These guys in the wintertime barnstorming would play together, and that's why a lot of the big league ball players at the time really advocated for integration. But I see the this is almost a story of white hats and black hats. And I really think I see Kennesaw Mountain Landis as the black hat. I don't know what your take on Landis is, but at every stop, he figures in this story. Not only in you mentioned a little bit of the Black Sox, but that's been gone over and over. But there was an interesting tangent to the Black Sox story, which had involved perhaps I'm a little dubious on the history, but Ty Cobb and Tris Speaker allegedly betting on a game late in the season in 1919, just before the World Series would have started between the Reds and the White Sox. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, that's fascinating, and it's a bit of baseball history I didn't know. I mean, this was something I came across. I probably had heard of it at some past time, but I certainly didn't register with me until I started doing the research into the book. So the whole Tris Speaker Ty Cobb scandal, I should put that in quotes, was a le It was an alleged scandal, really. It arises from a game that was played in late in the season in 1919, right before the Black Sox series with the Cincinnati Reds. And the allegations were made by a pitcher named Dutch Leonard, who had previously pitched. He had previously played for the Red Sox as a teammate of Tris Speaker, and he had played as a player for the Tigers when Ty Cobb was the manager there. So he basically got blackballed out of baseball in 1925. People hated him. I mean, Ty Cobb said
Okay.
of
I
his
wasn't quite sure about that in your writing, but it makes more sense that. No, anyway, go ahead.
So Leonard basically got blackballed out of baseball by Ty Cobb, who sold his contract to the Pacific Coast League after he cleared waivers, and when the waivers were available, Tris Speaker could have taken him, but Tris Speaker decided not to take him. Cobb sent him to the minor leagues. Dutch
Speaker was
Leonard
managing
refused.
player managing the Indians at the time.
Right. So this is all happening in the American League, and so Leonard was very bitter about this, and he felt like he had participated with Speaker and Cobb in a fixed game back in 1919. And as evidence, he had letters that were written to him by Cobb and by Smokey Joe Wood, who was a player with the Indians. So he had this hard evidence.
Yeah, I want to talk about that a little bit. Are we sure that these letters were authentic?
You're the first person who's raised that with me. It's been reported in the biographies of Cobb and Speaker, and I did not come across anything that suggested they weren't. And when Cobb and Speaker were interviewed by Judge Landis in December of 1926, they didn't assert that the letters were fake. So I think if they had been faked in some way, it would have come out.
Well, the letter that you quote from Cobb was a bit ambiguous on what may or may not have happened. And so let's backtrack a little bit. This happened in 1919. In the middle of the 1926 season, which makes this story so fascinating, that happens in 26. It's 6.5 years later, roughly, and Leonard comes out with this allegation that he keeps more or less under wraps, but it's 6.5 years later. He's been blackballed from baseball for several months now, or from the American League anyhow. He's moved back to California where he's a rancher, farmer, et cetera. He's mad at Cobb and Speaker, thinking they betrayed his trust or something. But as you state, nobody liked him, so maybe that was the motivation of getting him out. Like, nobody wanted to sign him. Sorry, you know, that happens in baseball. Sorry, you're a jerk. Nobody likes you, and you're not going to play.
Right. Well, I think you've summed it up really well. Leonard really felt like he'd been blackballed, and that it was Cobb and Speaker's fault, and that this, you know, denied him basically 2 years of salary, and because the year. In the year that he got sent to the minors or was sold to the minors, he was 14-11. He was 33 years old and still pitching productively. Cobb just didn't want him on his team. And so I think that over that period of time, from the time he got blackballed to the time he made the letters more public or brought them to the attention of Major League Baseball, he just got angrier and angrier. I mean, he was prospering out in California. He had a very prosperous farm. So it really wasn't a money issue. I think it was more of an ego issue and a revenge issue. And he even really admitted that later, that, you know, he had gotten his revenge because he took the letters to Ben Johnson, who was president of the American League, and said, I'm going to sell these to the newspaper unless you buy them. And so basically, Ben Johnson paid him $20,000.
Yeah. And that was big money at the time. That was
it was hush money, basically. You know, yeah. If Leonard would shut up about it, Ben Johnson would try to keep it quiet to protect the integrity of Major League Baseball. But of course, it got out.
It got out. And this is another fan. I read the book, but for crying out loud, this makes it even more interesting. I didn't know that Ben Johnson and Judge Landis, Commissioner Landis, had an ongoing feud. And so this, you know, Johnson had it taken care of most, let's say it was going to be okay. And then Landis put his finger in there.
Right. Yeah. Johnson thought he could keep it quiet. And from May until September, he did keep it quiet. There were only a few people who knew about the letters and what had happened. But then Ben Johnson felt he had to tell the other presidents of the American League. And in that meeting, the president of the American League said, you have to turn this over to Judge Landis. And that brought Landis in in conflict with Ben Johnson. The two of them had feuded for a long time. They were very similar men in a certain way. They were both devoted to baseball, but autocratic and egotistical. And Ben Johnson had been involved in baseball as an executive back into the 1800s. Landis really started his career in baseball in 1920. So there was a kind of rivalry also over each of their roles in past histories.
Yeah. And so fast forward, they end up coming to an agreement that both Speaker and Cobb would retire from the game of baseball. Cobb was 39, 40 years old. Speaker was roughly the same age. They both had long careers. There was no Hall of Fame at the time, but certain, like, Cobb was the best player in the game, pardon me, before Ruth came around. And he agreed to retire, but then there was a settlement. This was interesting. Like, so Speaker and Cobb were friends, and they end up going on a hunting trip. And I presumably to talk about what they were going to do, they decide to quote unquote retire. Well, they still had some playing days left. And what happens is you get they decide essentially that they want to play. So Landis forces the hand and makes their teams. So they were both player managers of their respective teams, Cobb with the Tigers, Speaker with the Indians. And then they're essentially somehow or another forced to the Tigers and the Indians were forced to release them. And Cobb, and I've read a little bit about this, but he had, you know, a swan song. He could go play for the most famous manager in baseball history, Connie Mack, for Philadelphia. I can't remember who Speaker played for in that intervening year, Washington, perhaps. And then he goes and joins Cobb for their final 1928 season. Well, it turns out that the Philadelphia Athletics had been building up a powerhouse underneath the Yankees. You talk about the 1927 Yankees, which you mention offhandedly in this book. They were a real powerhouse compared to this 26 team. But then the Athletics become the premier team and win two pennants after Cobb and Speaker both leave the team. So I think that's a fantastic thing that, man, this book would have been 700 pages if you wove all those stories together.
Right. I'd still be writing. Yeah. Yeah. And you're right. I mean, the Yankees, of course, the 1927 Yankees, the Murderers Row Yankees, was basically the same roster that they had in 26. It's just that some of their players matured. Ruth had to come back here. You know, he had 60 home runs in 27. But Gehrig was now a third-year player. Earl Combs was a third-year player. You know, they just became a better team, same roster, better team. And the Yankees won in 27 and 28 World Series wins, four straight sweeps. And then the Athletics won 29, 30, and 31, three straight American League pennants until they were dethroned in 32 by the 1932 Yankees.
They're called shot year. So, yeah. Maybe your next book is this interregnum between these two squads, perhaps.
Yeah.
I got a couple more questions before we finish. I don't know where to go here. I think you mentioned at the top Hornsby and Ruth. So I think this is an interesting thing. You know, the Hornsby's player manager, the Cardinals, they win the pennant, they win the World Series. Babe Ruth gets caught stealing. And I knew this, but like, it still baffles me even after reading it and like in the explanation. He gets caught stealing down 3-2, two outs in the ninth inning of game 7 of the World Series. And then the game's over. The game's just over. And Hornsby tags out Ruth to end the game on a stolen base. And it's like, man, there was a lot of weird stuff, but I think any coach now would see that and go apoplectic. Miller Huggins said, yeah, he's trying to make something happen. Ruth was like, I didn't think he was looking at me. I thought I could take the base. And for crying out loud, I don't know if you have any more insight on that stolen base, because that could be a book in of itself, I think.
Right. Well, I think it sort of exemplifies the era of the 1920s in some ways. I mean, risk takers. I mean, you had people performing on the wings of airplanes. You had Charles Lindbergh flying across the country. People were optimistic and believed in themselves and were willing to take risks. And it, you know, the risk Ruth took was a big one, of course. And as you set it up, you know, seventh game of the World Series, bottom of the ninth inning, one run game, Babe Ruth, and it's in Yankee Stadium. And the pitcher, of course, for the Cardinals is 39-year-old Grover Cleveland Alexander, who's the pitching hero of the 1926 World Series.
And his coup de grace of his entire career.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and Alexander won two games and saved one in Yankee Stadium. All three of those games were in Yankee Stadium in front of Yankee fans. So my take on Ruth stealing second base, or attempting to steal second base, There was only one stolen base in the whole series, but the Yankees achieved, which was Ruth stealing second base off Grover Cleveland Alexander in game six. So Ruth had it in his mind, I've already done this. I can do it again. And Ruth later said the way Alexander was pitching, and he hadn't given up a hit in his relief role. The way Alexander was pitching, we weren't going to get two hits in a row to get a run and send us to extra innings. So I needed to get to scoring position. And as you said, he thought Alexander wasn't paying attention to him. And Alexander did have a kind of slowed down demeanor on the mound. So I think he lulled Ruth into feeling that perhaps it was safer to steal or not. And we forget that the other individual in that whole sequence of four players that were in that sequence is the catcher, Bob O'Farrell, who was a superb catcher, a really excellent defensive catcher, who was the MVP in the National League in 1926. And he's the one who makes the throw to Hornsby to tag Ruth out. Ruth accepts it. He slides in. He's tagged out. He gets up. He shakes hands with Hornsby, congratulates him. You know, kind of good try, and game and series is over.
Well, I can't imagine that. What would go on today would be just, you wouldn't hear the end of it.
And of course, the 26th season, just to go just a step further, was also a kind of a launching pad for the St. Louis Cardinals, who had never been to a World Series, but won six of the next 21 World Series.
Yeah, rivaled the Yankees, and I mean, still to this day. They rivaled the Yankees, you know.
Yeah, from 26 to 46, 21 seasons, 15 of those World Series were won by either the Yankees or the Cardinals. First the Gas House Gang, then the DiMaggio years.
All right, and I got a couple more minutes. I think this is an important thing to address, the difference between the American League and the National League. One, I don't know if we're going to be able to address this in enough time, but Landis only allowed the aforementioned Cobb and Speaker to be taken a new contract to be signed by an American League team. He was not going to allow them to go to the National League. These were two separate leagues. They were two separate leagues really through the 80s, through the 90s even, and then in the mid-90s, they kind of coalesced a bit more. And then in the year 2000, they came under one umbrella as Major League Baseball, but they were two different leagues and they had different styles, different players. Players rarely moved between leagues like they do now. And I think my contention is that not only you had the American League, you had the National League. In 1914, you mentioned briefly the Federal League. And this is also the time that Black baseball was trying to get in. But there's all these competing leagues with different influences, and it became it really became American League and National League as the forces and the two major leagues that we know of today. There are now considered, I don't know how many, there's probably 8 or 10, 12 statistics or leagues that they pull statistics from, including the a lot of the Negro League stuff. My contention is that I think the players should be recognized and all this stuff, but I think there's also many seasons within the American National League that should not be recognized as major league quality. 1918 being one, 1943, 44, I'd argue 1981, 1994, and certainly 2020. I don't know what you do about the stats. It's an entirely different question, but calling them a championship season. Not my point. My point is you have the American League and the National League, and that they were rivals. And they were rivals when I was growing up. The All-Star Game meant something. They wanted to beat each other's brains in. It was a different style of game even prior to the designated hitter, I think, is the delineation mark we see in modern times, but really they were different leagues.
Yeah, and we've mentioned earlier there was also the Negro Leagues, where there was also a different style of ball. I mean, each league sort of nurtured a kind of strategy and a kind of way of playing the game. And as you think back, I think of how exciting it must have been to be a fan in Chicago or Philadelphia or New York or in Boston, where you could watch teams from both leagues in the same city.
I guess the point is that the World Series meant something a lot more back then when these two leagues came together at the end of the year, no interleague play. They'd play each other in spring training sometimes, but spring training wasn't even as organized as it is now. They'd barnstorm their way up the coast and play exhibitions in towns that had decent weather all the way up to the north, where, you know, they'd start their season mid-April, not March 28th or whatever they do now. And they'd wait for the weather to be good, and then they'd end. I think the 1926 season ended on September 19th. World Series starts October 2nd. It's weather related. And they packed their schedule in the summertime full of doubleheaders. And it's not like that today, but I don't know. Interesting. I don't know where we go with that, but we're running out of time, Tom.
Well, it's part of the great narrative of baseball history, which goes back to the 1800s. And I mean, there is no other sport that we follow. Maybe boxing and horse racing would be exceptions, but certainly no other team sport that we are aware of that has such a long history with so many different changes of personnel, as well as philosophy and style of play.
Well, I appreciate your time here again today, Tom. It's wonderful. I really enjoyed the book, and I enjoyed the other book, The Called Shot, quite a bit too, because it's a very similar narrative where you're weaving historical characters into the story. I like that too. I encourage you y'all to pick that up. Baseball in the Roaring 20s, Yankees, Cardinals, and captivating 1926 season. You get that from University of Nebraska Press. Any last words, Tom?
Just go out and enjoy baseball. You know, go to the park, minor league park, major league park. It's a great game. People should keep going to, should be filling up the stands.
There you go. All right. Appreciate your time. We'll talk to you later, Tom. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you. Appreciate it.